Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
There are two narratives right now. And the two narratives are as follows. The Obamaites have the narrative that he inherited the worst economy in history, that the economy was destroyed by George Bush and the Republicans, that Obama the Great rescued us and pulled us out of the hole. The other narrative is that the people who put the charlatan in power purposely crashed the economy in order to usher in Obama so they can continue to rape the Treasury. We're going to continue to talk about the fact that you're being hoodwinked again, the fact that you're being lied to again, the fact that the left is claiming the debt ceiling deal is a victory for the Tea Party, which is a lie. Because if they're telling you, if the left is telling you that it's a victory for the Tea Party, you know it's a lie. And I'm going to ask you, which programs do you fear will be chosen for the deepest cuts? Obviously, those which benefit conservatives and our national security. They're not going to cut 1 cent out of Acorn funding, etc. Now, who came out the worst in this deal, John Boehner or Barack Obama? I think it's pretty clear it was a grand slam for both of them, frankly. And I want to tell you right now that I've studied this economy in pretty much in great detail for my book, Trickle Up Poverty. And I want to go back to what I wrote then. I'm not going to read from the book, but I found an essay on this that I wrote. I don't even think it wound up in the book. And I'm going to go back to Lenin, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, because Obama is truly a Leninist, not even a Marxist. Many of the fake Republicans are saying, well, he's no Marxist. No, they're right. He's a Leninist. You see, Lenin had a vision. A disturbed vision. Lenin thought that a nation could only grow more prosperous when controlled by a vanguard, an elite, a group of people who know better than you what to do with your property. The Leninist elite would lead people to a world free of pain and poverty. There would be no more haves and have-nots, no more private property, just boundless prosperity. All a nation had to do was transfer its entire wealth to Lenin's vanguard. The Leninist vision, of course, had consequences. If you did not want to relinquish your private property, Leninists would just take it. For in addition to being a socialist elite, Leninists were also an elite of thieving, murdering thugs. Furthermore, Leninism's centralized decision-making created horrific iniquities. Famine, not abundance, was just one consequence of Leninism in the ex-Soviet Union. In the Leninist world, the rich grow poorer and the poor grow poorer. The government, which controls every piece of property, right down to the last peppercorn, grows immensely rich, as do the party apparatchiks who control all goods and services. At its very core, Leninism is not about empowering workers or about delivering abundance. Leninism is about redistributing a nation's wealth to a government elite. While Leninists say they detest private property, they use the state to hoard property for their own uses. As one Eastern European dissident observed, communism simply created the new class of powerful bureaucrats. But today's policymakers can learn very important lessons from Lenin. Leninist notions of property teach us the errors of redistributing wealth. Leninist organizational tactics teach us the terror that can result from empowering bureaucrats at the expense of the individual. And given the failed history of socialism, you have to ask yourself why Barack Obama appears intent on repeating the errors of Lenin and his followers. Make no mistake about it. The Obama administration wants to redistribute wealth. It wants to take the wealth of the nation's productive class and deliver it to the state. The administration will take this wealth through taxes. It will take this wealth through eminent domain. It will take this wealth through increased regulation. The end result? America's rich will be poorer. America's poor will be poorer. America's middle class will be wiped out. But America's government will be more powerful than ever, as will the elected officials and their select bureaucrats. You see, Obama's Leninism comes in many forms for those of you who are naive enough to believe that I don't know what I'm talking about. Obama himself is the individual expression of government elitism. He attended fancy schools. He befriended radical chic elitists like William Ayers. He believes that government, when staffed by fellow elitists, can do almost anything. It can run businesses, defeat market forces, and control the weather. It can even cure cancer. Obama sounds smart, so it must all be true, argue his followers. All Obama asks is that you let him and his bureaucrats control an increasing share of our nation's wealth and property. You know, the federal government has a stake in General Motors and Citigroup, or at least it did till recently. In light of record deficits and recent unemployment numbers, the nation does not seem to be any better off, even though the government took over General Motors and Citigroup. Still, Obama wants the state to control more of our property, more of our wealth. He asks us to give him increased control of our health care system so that we can make the country healthier. He asks us to give him more control of our nation's energy so that he can set the global thermostat. There are costs to Obamanomics, just as there were consequences to Leninism. Forget the fact that the federal government still has not figured out how to pay for the promises it has made over the past several decades. This is not about balancing budgets. It is about the Obamanistas aggregating wealth. The more they get, the more powerful they become. Joe Biden called the Tea Party's terrorists. And this is where the rich come in. Obama needs their money to finance his acquisition of the private sector. He cannot take it at gunpoint as Lenin did in Russia. So he has to use taxation and regulation. Now, what I'm going to say to you in the next two sentences should be memorized and written down, boys and girls of the Savage Nation. Over the past three decades, this government has been taking wealth from the producers, the job creators, the savers, and the innovators. Pay attention to what I'm going to read to you. In 1987, the richest 1% paid roughly one quarter of all income taxes. The bottom 50% paid 6% of all taxes. That was in 87. Fast forward to 2007 when I last had the data. And the richest 1% were paying 40% of all income taxes, and the bottom 50% are paying just under 3%. So in other words, the bottom pay less, the middle pay more, the rich pay more. In other words, the productive class is already picking up a disproportionate share of our government's TAM. And still, things seem to be getting worse. We have a government running record deficits. We have millions upon millions who are underemployed or worse, unemployed. We have a socialized medical plan called Medicare Part A that will go bust in 2017. The United States has at least $50 trillion in unfunded obligations, all on account of policymakers like Obama, who think that the redistribution of wealth makes a nation richer, not poorer. Ladies and gentlemen, the trouble with socialism, as one once observed, is that you eventually run out of other people's money. Here is a better idea from the Savage Nation. Let's not raise taxes for the producers. Let's cut their taxes. Let's let the producers keep their money and invest it in their ideas. If the idea works, they will create jobs and empower individuals. If the idea fails, then it is back to the drawing board without a government check. The advantage of this approach is that it rewards the producers without empowering the bureaucrats. And as the producers grow wealthy, so does the nation.
Savage.
Obama has committed almost every one of the abuses listed in the Declaration of Independence. He has trampled on the rights of our individualism. He has trampled on the rights of state governments. He has also, by refusing to rein in spending and by growing the national debt from $9 trillion in 2009 to more than $14.5 trillion in 2011, he has not only bankrupted America, I don't think we can ever climb out of this. One last statistic. It took America to go from 1789, as I said before, to the year 2008, took this country $9 trillion in federal debt. It took 1789 to 2008 to rack up $9 trillion in federal debt. But it took Obama only 3 years to increase that 200-year debt load by 50%. Now, what sense, which school of economics did you go to which says that if you're spending far more than you are taking in your own household, the answer is to spend more? What school of economy are you studying? What school of economics are you referring to? Which school of economics says you spend when you don't have the money to spend by borrowing more? I don't know it. I know this. I know this as a father who has worked hard, who has grown children. When we were younger, there were things I wanted to buy I couldn't afford to buy. I remember it to this day. Back in the early 80s. I had two young children. I was putting myself through school. Actually, I was out of school. I was struggling, but I wanted to buy a new Porsche. Oh, did I want a chocolate brown Porsche with a, in those days, there was a fashionable bib that was put on the front of them. And I saw myself in that car, but I couldn't afford it. Instead, I drove a broken old Volvo. I mean, I remember it to this day. It was four on the floor. It was slow as could be, but it got me where I wanted to go. I liked the car because it was a very good car, but it's not the car I wanted. I wanted a better car, a faster car, a flashier car. I couldn't afford it. Now, if I went to a bank and I said, could you lend me some money so I can buy a chocolate brown Porsche? The banker would have said, well, what collateral do you have? What income do you have? And he would have turned me down on that loan. He wouldn't have said, sure, go buy three Porsches. I come from the Obama School of Economics. Let me give you a new split-level home in the fanciest neighborhood in the country. And I would have said, but I can't afford that. Don't worry about it. We'll pay for it. And if you can't make the payments, Harry Reid will make the payments for you. Do you get the picture? That's exactly what this drunken sailor called the President of the United States has done to us. I don't know how you don't understand this. Sometimes I can't understand how stupid the American people can be to not see that this man is laughing as he does this to you. He's laughing at you. He's mocking you. He understands that he should have been stopped by now. But since you haven't stopped him, he's going to dig his heels in and he's going to do a lot more damage. I can guarantee it. He has taken the national debt from $9 trillion to $14.5 trillion. Now, many of you brainwashed fools say, well, the Republicans did it. George Bush did it. Well, it is true. There was $9 trillion in national debt when Obama took office, but now it's almost $15 trillion. Does that make sense to you? How can you then say that Bush did it? Bush was a disaster as a president. I criticized Bush for years. I warned you about Bush being a liberal Republican. It was no secret to me what he was doing. But now we see what Obama has done. It took Obama only 3 years to increase that 200-year debt load by 50%. 50%. And I will tell you again, in Obama's first 3 years, the national debt climbed from slightly more than 40% of GDP to 98% of GDP. And what he just did during the summer of 2011, he fought the American people to increase the federal debt by another $2.5 trillion. And Obama, the trickster, knew that his debt increase would make the debt larger than 110% of the entire U.S. economy. But he did not care. Interest payments on the debt have surged from 15% of the federal income in 08 to more than 40% of federal income in 2011. So almost half of every dollar the Fed's take in goes right back out to our creditors in China.
Savage.
Admittedly, we have the most incompetent, corrupt administration in history. Yes. But I believe that the founding fathers were so brilliant that they anticipated a day that an imposter like this would wind up in the White House. The entire Constitution was written to protect the people from Obama. My belief is that the entire Constitution was written foreseeing the day that an imposter communist would take over the country, the White House, and try to impose his will on the people with every trick in the book. But to couple with that, you have a complacent, a supine media like I've never seen. I watched Obama's press conference. I had to stop eating. I have never seen anything like it. One loaded laugh, one loaded question after another. And the last question was saved for some stooge from NPR who basically gets up and says, Mr. Obama, do you have any hope that the Republicans will be nice? Listen to clip 15.
Can you share with us why you have some hope, actually, if it is an outcome?
I always have hope. Don't you remember my campaign?
You hear? You hear the schmucks? These are our press. This is the press, national press, sitting there. He makes a stupid, tepid joke, and right away they're in laughter like the principal came into a classroom. I never saw anything like this. Where is the press? When did this happen? Where did the hardened reporters go? When did they disappear? When were they replaced by these sad sacks laughing at a president's tepid jokes when they should be the ones pressing him on saying, wait a minute, tell us why you're pushing raising taxes and spending more when it's not worked It didn't work in Eastern Europe. Why are you trying to push that model on the American economy? You think one person would ask that question? They were all handpicked. They were all handpicked. So that's why it's hard for me to watch television at all anymore. I admit I watch too much television, but I can't watch the news at all. I can't even watch cable television news. You forget about it. I mean, even Fox, they do a fairly good job, but I can't even watch that. It is so cut and dry. There's no real emotion in it. There's no real gutsy opinion in it. It's all cut and dried. You know what I watch a lot on TV? I got to tell you, I watch movies. I admit it. Too many at night. I admit it. The clicker now has become like a second, third hand. Sorry. Can't help it. I'm entitled. Chinese food, Italian food, occasionally Indian food, and then the clicker. What can I do? I do ride the bike and go out on the boat, and I do look at the moon at night on a full moon night, and I do watch the birds, and I do know what a peregrine falcon looks like. But the fact of the matter is far too many screens in my life. The computer all day with the call screen is on my left side. I got a call screen that says Tom from New York says Catholic saying. On the right side, I have the wires which show me all the websites and what's breaking, and then the dog is sleeping under the desk. And I leave here, I go home. About I don't know how much time there is between now and when I watch television, but not honest to God, it's getting it. I'm addicted to screens, and I was a guy who resisted all of these things. I'm addicted now. I'm a total addict. I am a total addict of the screen. There's nothing I can do. But, you know, you got to go with it. You know, as Aristotle and Onassis said, if you're going to get raped, you may as well enjoy it. I mean, the fact of the matter is I'm enjoying the Internet more than ever. I don't feel guilty about it. Do you have Internet guilt? Has anyone written that yet? Go steal my idea. Do any of you have Internet guilt that you spend too much time on the computer, not enough time with your children? Or that you're spending more time on the computer than you are with your wife? Well, that you can understand. That's an old Henny Youngman joke. Even though there were no computers then, same kind of thing. Take my wife, please. But the fact of the matter is, we're all addicted to the computer. If you have an IQ over 19, you're addicted to the computer. Let's say you meet someone who doesn't, he says he doesn't, I still meet people. I know a guy who's a lawyer, he just says, oh no, I don't have internet, I don't go on. I don't have cell phone, I don't talk to him anymore. Who could know a person like this? What is that, like a reverse snobbery? I don't have internet, I don't do email, I don't do texting, I don't have a cell phone. With God's will and your listenership, I shall return.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Jonathan in New York on WOR. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, sir. The union labor movement, my belief, is critical and fundamental to the existence of a middle class in this country. And the demonization, in broad general terms, of the union labor movement, I think, is terribly unfair and doesn't speak to the history.
Your first statement is that unions are necessary for the survival of the middle class.
Correct, sir.
Well, the fight in the fight is actually the middle class who threw the Democrat socialists out, who were saying no to the union. So how do you define the middle class? The voters are, by, let's say, definition, generally middle class. And if you add up all the numbers, wouldn't you say most voters are members of the middle class?
No, I wouldn't necessarily subscribe to that generalization. I think people.
Okay. Well, you say that most voters are rich.
I say most voters vote across a broad spectrum of economic.
Yeah, but by and large, would you say that there are more rich voting than more middle class or more poor voting? Would you say that in any election, generally, isn't it generally outweighed by the poor and the middle class rather than the rich? There aren't that many rich. So by by numbers, you can't say that the vote is dominated by the rich, can you?
Well, I think the polls, to a certain extent, are dominated the rich, but not necessarily because of their vote in the ballot boxes, because of the financial influence that they exert with respect to political contributions.
Oh, you mean like poor Obama, who had a struggle to get the $1 trillion to become president? Where did that money come from?
For very wealthy constituents and a broad base of small contributors because of.
So now you want it both ways. Now you say that Obama was elected by poor people and very rich people.
Well, he won the election, I think.
Well, but I'm saying, where did the $1 trillion come from? How did an unknown senator raise $1 trillion? Where did it come from?
Through powerful political connections.
Okay, but let's go back to your main point. My point is that the middle class is rebelling against the unions because the unions don't represent the interests of the middle class. The middle class are the ones who pay the taxes, after all. They're saying we're taxed to death and we think the teachers should pay a fair share of their health care and their pensions. So how can you say it's the middle class that the unions represent when they don't represent the middle class?
I would disagree with that point because I think the broad range of people who are represented by collective bargaining agreements and who are union members, whether they're teachers, firemen, policemen, garbage men, toll collectors.
Right. And you don't think that most of them are overpaid and their pensions are too high? You think pensions of $150,000 a year are the correct pensions for firemen?
I think.
You think that the middle class can afford cop pensions of that magnitude or fireman pensions of that magnitude? You've seen what's coming out and what kind of monies they're taking in.
But I think in any instance,
I mean, by your own definition, the cops and firemen are retiring, are now members of the rich.
I don't happen to subscribe to that fact because, first of all, I'm a member of two separate unions. Wait a minute.
What fact are we talking about? Cops and firemen are retiring with gargantuan pensions that the states and cities can't afford. They're the pensions that you would normally associate with the rich, not with the middle class. You see the kinds of numbers. They've been all over your newspapers in New York. You know that. I'm not making this up.
There are some extreme examples and some unfair practices like in any other area, but for the most part, the general membership of the...
Oh, really? Are you sure that most cops don't fake sicknesses in their last year on the job in order to qualify for a certain disability benefit that adds to their pension in their last year so their pension goes up by 30%? You don't think that's a standard tactic being used now across America?
It happens, but I don't think you can general...
Well, I think if you studied it as closely as I have, you'd see that it's more generalized than you may imagine. But let's get back to your main point, Jonathan. You think the unions are necessary to protect or sustain the middle class? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
Okay, then let's use the example of the auto industry. Is it not true that the unions destroyed the auto industry in Detroit because of the extraordinary salaries, pensions, and benefits that they demanded for their auto workers?
I think what destroyed the auto...
Wait a minute. Excuse me. Why do you think they moved their factories to Mexico? Because they couldn't afford to build a car in Detroit. They got so lazy and so fat on union contracts that the whole middle class was destroyed in Detroit because of the unions. It was the unions who through greed, destroyed the middle class. Jonathan, come on. Listen, you're probably a nice guy. When I was younger, you and I probably would have been friends, but I have an older man's wisdom. The fact of the matter is, when you think about this again after the radio show, you know, in the middle of the night when you lay down, you know, Savage raised a good point, that the unions destroyed the auto industry. And the proof is that they moved the factories to Mexico. You look at half the cars that were made in Detroit, they're made in Mexico now. Why? Because there's no union wages, no union pensions, no union health care. Yet the people in Mexico are producing nice cars. They're doing it for a decent wage. They're not living on nothing a day. They're making a decent wage, but they're not making the extraordinarily high wages with the high benefits that the auto workers demanded out of the auto companies in Detroit. So I think your argument has been destroyed by mere fact that I've given you one major example, a clear one at that, of how unions, in fact, do not support the middle class, but often decimate it.
Savage.
Talk radio is not only not dead, but talk radio is very much alive. Although the midstream media has been claiming for years now that talk radio is dead, that the empty skirts who have been saying that this is a medium only for fringe extremists or old men, that talk radio is only for old men, I've proven them all wrong. Talk Radio Network and Michael Savage are partners. We've been in business together since when? 2000? Now, we all hear that the Internet is the king, and a lot of people ran to the Internet with their advertising money. Yet everyone knows that no one's been able to monetize their investment in the Internet. Nobody. You see, talk radio is a medium that you can't hide yourself easily in. You can't hide behind a mustache. and such. 3 hours a day, Jerry. 3 hours a day, Jerry. Mr. Mustache on Fox. And unless you have a massive production staff who is talking for you, you're not going to get very far, right? But I don't have a massive staff. I have a very small and very good staff. And when you do talk radio right, people get to know you. People get to understand that you're a real person, and they relate to you. What I'm saying is I've proven that talk radio is a very vibrant medium today. People who listen to talk radio are more acutely aware of what's going on than the average American. Although the fraudulent elites, or shall I say the self-proclaimed drug addicts with microphones and cameras in front of their faces, laugh at you, the average listener to talk radio is far more knowledgeable politically than they would like you to believe. And by the way, listeners to talk radio vote both with their wallets and their ballots. Play the clip.
I'm not afraid of anybody. This is a tough game. You can't be intimidated. You can't be frightened. As far as I'm concerned, the Tea Party can go straight to hell.
Did you hear that? And it's organizations like the AARP who control these leftist politicians. AMAC is fighting back. The Association of Mature American Citizens. Your membership can help stop the left wing. Call 800-255-4199, 800-255-4199, or go to americaisrising.com, 800-255-4199, americaisrising.com.
Savage.
The government is uncomfortable with independent analysts like myself. I didn't say that I have inside information, but I have a fundamental ability to think, so I'm asking questions that an informed citizen not only should ask, but is asking. And I'm asking who was in charge of making that decision to put all of those SEALs in one helicopter, number one. Number two, why has no one been fired? That's the start with. Then we have the financial meltdown. Again, nobody's taking responsibility. We got Obama saying it's not my fault, tax the rich, even though he's every other day he's with the rich. Then you got the idiot of idiots, the biggest... There's no words for Geithner. Everyone knows he's an office boy. Everybody knows that Geithner is an office boy for people who are making billions of dollars on Wall Street. Everyone knows that. The guy looks it, he sounds it, and he is it. Fairness doctrine that we thought was put to rest? A new FCC commissioner, one of them, warns of a backdoor way into the fairness doctrine. There could still be an effort to finding a backdoor to eliminate Michael Savage and others in talk radio. A proposal that would give the federal government the ability to make sure broadcasters serve their communities could also be used to wedge in principles of the fairness doctrine. The government could be compiling data as to what kind of content you were airing and whether the government thought that was appropriate content. You hear this? The government has to decide whether it's appropriate content? You mean I'm criticizing Geithner, so he says that's inappropriate content? Or I'm criticizing some doofus in the military for this decision, so he says, oh, hey, get him off the air, that's inappropriate content. That's communism, Johnson. I'll have 10 million people marching around America. How's that? You try to pull this one, I'll organize 10 million people with everybody else in radio. It could be political speech, they say. It could be shows on baking or gardening. But we don't know where the government is headed. This is your government at work. This is your government at work. But the worst of your foes is the sun over Ed. You must wear your helmet for all that is said. If he finds you uncovered, he'll knock you down dead, and you'll die like a fool of a soldier, fool, fool, fool of a soldier. When first under fire and you're wishful to duck, don't look nor take heed at the man that is struck. Be thankful you're living and trust to your luck, and march to your front like a soldier, front, front, front like a soldier. And when you're wounded and left on Afghanistan's plains, and the women come out to cut up what remains, just go to your God like a soldier. Go, go, go like a soldier. Go, go, go like a soldier. Go, go, go like a soldier. Soldier of the Queen. This is Dr. Dissident Michael Savage back in a moment.
Savage.
Michael Savage.com. I don't want to talk about the news. I really don't. I would rather talk about phagocytosis. Those of you who understand what I just said, it is a medical term. Phagocytosis is a medical term that I recall from my days of studying about free radical pathology and antioxidants. And phagocytosis, you can't even say words today. They're in the medical books for fear somebody's liable to complain to somebody. I do have a doctorate in epidemiology and human nutrition. I do remember my studies of antioxidants. Everyone says antioxidant, they don't know what it means. Oh, yes, I'm taking my antioxidants. You don't know what it means, but you're taking them. It's like saying I'm eating my carrots. You're not a rabbit. Now, it is true that you should eat carrots once in a while and your broccoli. But how many of you really know what a free radical is? You have no idea what it is. Harry Reid is a free radical. Nancy Pelosi is a free radical. Andrea Mitchell is a free radical. Charlie Rangel is a free radical. Barack Obama is the number one free radical. Problem is no one scavenged any of them yet. That's why I'm talking about free radical pathology. They're out of control. They're devouring the body politic. We absolutely need antioxidants to control them. See, I could put this into a medical context, and we might actually get somewhere. You're talking about a degenerative disease. What they're doing to the body politic is like a degenerative disease that's about to kill a patient. So if I told you that I've written about the free radical theory of aging in 1972 in a popular book called Nutrition Against Aging, you'd say, ah, but sure, he didn't do that. Why, we don't know him. We have no idea who he is, even though he wrote the book. We'll deny he wrote the book because we're like the ex-Soviet Union, where anyone who disagrees with our communist policies are immediately ejected from the cult of left-wing mania. So as I say, you can learn an awful lot about life by studying biology and disease mechanisms. And in many ways, what Harry Reid and Obama and Pelosi and all are doing to this country is the equivalent of what free radicals do to our cells. Invade, cause biological damage, and then kill the cell. They don't understand it because none of them really went to... I would say they don't even understand what I just said. They probably turn it over to the Secret Service because they're so intolerant of inflammation. I'm actually a safety net for the nation, when you think about it. The people who hate me the most need me the most. I had a doctor friend that once told me that we are addicted to that which we are allergic to. I said, wait, say that again, Dr. Cathcart. He said, we are usually addicted food-wise now to that which we are allergic. And you know, I actually found out he was right. The things, in other words, that we like the most in foods are the things that get us the sickest. It's 100% true. Let's say you have a sugar addiction. That's the thing that's getting you the sickest. Okay, that's an example. And a guy like Harry Reid, who wants to go home and work on his pomegranates, is addicted to big government spending. Big government and spending, spending, spending. They don't understand that they're mentally deranged. They don't understand that they are destroying the nation that they claim to love. And what they don't understand is that in order to stop this, we need some antioxidants like Michael Savage, like the true conservatives, the fiscal conservatives, who understand that if free radicals are let to run wild in a cell or in a body, they'll destroy it, in the same way that free radicals who are running wild in our Congress are destroying the body politic. Do you get it? Do you understand why my background in biomedicine gives me the intelligence and the genius to understand things that fools can't understand at all? I'm going to tell you about lipid peroxide formation. I'm going to tell you about vitamin E and glutathione peroxidase. I'm like vitamin E for this country. I'm the best thing the country could ever have. You need more of me. I am vitamin E, and they are the free radicals who are destroying the country. They're like ozone. Charlie Rangel, Barack Obama, Harry Reid, the whole left-wing cabal, they're like ozone damaging the cell. I mean, we hear about ozone, and ozone is going to damage us. Well, it's true. But what about politicians who damage us? And then they take people like me, who are the antioxidants, and they say that we're the danger, we're the bad guys, the fools on television. I listen to them, I cannot believe it. The worst of them now, actually the worst, oh, am I glad I didn't give him an interview, that fraud from England. He won't be long for the TV. Martin Bashir, one of the biggest fakers in the history. He thinks that the pseudo-British accent, which for him is real, but it's pseudo for him because he's not even... The fake British accent that he puts on, he thinks he adds sophistication. None of the limeys make it in television. They don't make it. The American people don't go for that fake British accent. You know, he wanted to interview me when he was with 2020. He tried to con me over and over again on the British ban, and I wouldn't take the bait. He sent me letters about his illnesses and this and that. I knew he was a left-wing operative and a fanatic. My God, I watched this guy. I thought he had some degree of integrity and intelligence. He's worse than Andrea Mitchell on her worst days of the month. And I don't mean that in any derogatory fashion. I mean when she's not functioning well on television is what I mean by that. So again, as I say, if I talk about free radicals and what free radicals do to a cell and the degenerative process of free radicals on the cell, and I tell you that we need antioxidants like Michael Savage and fiscal conservatives, those of you who understand the rudiments understand what I'm saying. But fools like those, Martin Bashir, who's the guy with the tight dungarees, whose only claim to fame is that he's the stupidest man on television? Who is that idiot who called the Arab Spring something good for the world? That moron should be arrested. He should be arrested and taken to The Hague for what he did, putting out that propaganda. Who is that guy with the tight dungarees from West Hollywood? That fool. Anderson Cooper. He thinks because they had tight dungarees and had a good behind and they walked around a BlackBerry, they were good. What a moron. How do these guys function? How do they function? They're so stupid. I never saw anything like it. A showgirl's son like that. Pretty boy. Another pretty boy. Get him a job in the endogenous chemical mediators of inflammation. Shall I talk about the endogenous chemical mediators of inflammation? Guys like Anderson Cooper are the equivalent of histamine. They're the equivalent of an inflammatory reaction in the body politic. They don't even know it, though. They're like a foot abscess. Anderson Cooper may look good, but he's like a foot abscess that you have to cure. Does that make sense to you? Andrea Mitchell is like edema of the lungs that you need surgery for.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
If you are a wealthy CEO or health hedge fund manager in America right now,
health fund
your taxes
manager?
Are lower than they have ever been. They're lower than they've been since the 1950s. And you can afford it. You'll still be able to ride on your corporate jet. You're just going to have to pay a little more.
I'm leaving on a jet plane. I don't.
So now, according to the college teacher, the Marxist in the White House, if you make $250,000 a year or more, you are now a jet owner. Welcome to the Savage Nation. What? Where shall I begin with this? How many different ways can we talk about the hypocrisy, the lies, the outrage, the inanity of the press corps? Shall I just tell you emotionally, I watched this morning and said anymore. I did 15 years ago. Today I yelled at the television set. Today I had to turn it off. Today I was enraged watching this con man. You see, you know, it's very hard to talk about this today without talking about race. So let's talk about it right up front. I allege that there's not a white president in history who could get away with what he's getting away with in an economy like this. I allege that the press corps is cowardly and they are afraid of being called racist because none of them asked him one question that was really daring. The man said that Obama says his daughters finished their homework, this and that. He brings up the daughters. And then he says, you got to listen to clip one.
These are bills that Congress ran up. The money's been spent. The obligations have been made. So this isn't a situation. I think the American people have to understand this. This is not a situation where Congress is going to say, okay, we won't buy this car or we won't take this vacation. They took the vacation. They bought the car. And now they're saying,
Mr. President, could you please stop for a minute and tell us how you can justify your wife and daughters and your nieces and your mother-in-law being on a vacation at a time like this? See, now that's what a press member should have said, but no one said that. Secondly, he was lying when he said the Congress had spent this money. He's trying to pass the buck. It's a classic shuck and jive. He's passing the buck to Congress. He forced Congress to spend the money. Him and Nancy Pelosi, they are the ones who took a $1 trillion deficit, which they inherited from George Bush, the previous liberal president, and turned it into a $3 trillion deficit. And now he's saying they spent the money? Would you say that this man is a frugal president by comparison to other presidents? Would you say that the way he lives and the way he vacations and the way his wife vacations, you know she has 40 personal assistants? Do you know that she travels with an entourage where they book entire hotels? Would you say that these are frugal inhabitants of the White House? You know that they're not. You know that they're trashing the White House. You know that they've debased the presidency with their actions, their policies, their behavior. Yes, I'll say it because I see it the way it is. So now he calls people earning $250,000 a year or more jet owners. Jet owners now. Jet owners. Someone earning $250,000 a year or more, that's you if you're a tax, if you're a business owner. You're going to get a tax increase in 2012. You can't afford a jet. I doubt that you'd even charter a jet if you make $250,000 a year. As a matter of fact, a teacher makes about $110,000 a year with benefits. So two teacher family is making about $250,000 a year. That's right. A two teacher family is making $250,000 a year. Now, they're the core of the liberal base, the teacher. And yet now they're being targeted by Obama, as I warned you he would do, and trickle up poverty. Obama's war on the middle class. I warned that. I warned you of this.
Savage.
Talk radio is still dominant in terms of the world of political ideas in this country. I did it on this show. It was done nowhere else. We kept hearing talk radio is this, talk radio is that. It's only for old people. Talk radio is dead. Cable news is king. Internet is king. I don't say they don't have a powerful influence. You got to be a fool not to say so. At this stage, though, you'd have to admit, no matter how much of a doubting Thomas you are, that Michael Savage has rescued talk radio from the gallows. Talk Radio Network, an independent syndicator. I work with the best team in talk radio. They know me. They're like my friends, all the guys in the back room. It's unbelievable to me. This is a family. This is a team. We are the Yankees of talk radio. If anyone out there has been doubting whether talk radio still is powerful, let me tell you something. It is more powerful today than it ever has been in my 16-year career. Much more powerful today. More listeners than ever. More influence than ever. That's if you're in the inner ring. If you're in the inner ring, you have an audience that needs you and listens to you. And if you make sense, well, you're gonna make a lot of friends.
Let's go to New York City on WOR. Time is short. Jay, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Savage. You've been saying for such a long time that liberalism is a mental disorder, and I wanted to give you an example that I heard that really reminded me of that. I heard another station, a progressive, saying that we should devote as much attention to Christian fanaticism and Christian radicalism as far as terror attacks go, as we would to Islamic terrorism.
Yeah, and that's the latest thing. That's coming from the Muslim fanatics who are in the Homeland Security Department. That's the official line of the federal family under Big Sis. She figured out that if you can bash Christians, you can curry favor with the Muslims. You know what I mean? And there's an awful lot of Muslims voting for Obama these days because his middle name ain't Christ. His middle name is Muhammad. See, I mean, his middle name ain't Muhammad nor Christ. I mean, his middle name, as you well know, is Hussein. And so, therefore, you got to understand where the numbers are. You're asking me another question, which is what causes liberalism the mental disorder? Isn't that your real question?
I mean, essentially, when I heard this...
Well, what causes liberalism is the desire to be loved. Liberals generally want to be loved by everybody. They don't want anyone to dislike them.
I want to be loved by you, just you, nobody else but you.
And it is. And by the way, most liberals are nice people. Most of them are very nice people. They don't bother anybody. They want to be left alone. And they figure that if they stay out of your life, you'll like them and they'll, you know, basically they're good. And their idea of a conservative is a Nazi. They think that most Republicans secretly have SA or SS uniforms and a picture of Hitler in their living room. And this, of course, is an example of the insanity of liberalism in its extremes, just as there are extremes on the conservative side, as exemplified by, I don't know who. Really, I don't even know of any extremists anymore. I think they've all left the right side. They're all leftists today. But nevertheless, the fact is that liberals have this horrible prejudice against any Republican, assuming... Look at it this way. Most liberals think of them, try to visualize what a liberal is. In the form of a woman, it would be Larry David. In the form of a man, it would be Larry David. In the form of a woman, it would be Larry David in drag. That would be a woman liberal who at every turn, every chance he gets, he bashes Christians, the cross, or Christianity, and assumes that any Republican is a Nazi. This is a product of growing up, in my opinion, in a kind of a labor front home in New York City. As a child, oil cloth on the floor. The father worked in the ILGWU, even though he was a man. He was in the needle trades one way or the other. And hated the owners and thought that one day there would be a workers' revolution and the workers would run the country. Well, take a look at every country where the workers have taken over and you'll see what happens when workers take over. I don't want to go down that road. So that's it. Basically, liberals are nice people, but they're mentally deranged at a certain point.
Savage.
Sing along. We're all Islamists now. Welcome to the New World Order of Barack Hussein Obama. We're all in love with the Arab Spring. We all live in one big yellow submarine. Don't you understand how it's working yet? But the reason I'm playing the Yellow Submarine song in the Savage Nation is because I had an astounding dream during which I kept hearing Yellow Submarine, and I don't listen to the Beatles. I don't know why. Here it was. I'm listening in my dream. Yellow Submarine is playing. There's an Egyptian scene. There's sort of an ancient tomb of some type. And on the tomb, there's a pharaonic image of a woman seated, a seated woman. And a live woman walks next to it or is led next to it by invisible hands. And she is asked to sit down on a bench, which kind of parallels the silhouette that was carved into the tomb. And her figure matches the silhouette carved into the tomb perfectly, and she is immediately brought into the next world by whoever controls the next world. I would say God pulls her to the next world. Next, it is my turn. Invisible hands are pulling me forward. I'm not resisting. I'm just being pushed forward to the tomb, and my silhouette is on that tomb, and it matches, and I feel myself being pulled into the next world, and I start to scream, no, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. No, I'm not ready to go. I want to be here for my family and my children. I had a fight with all of my inner power. This is all while I'm sleeping, to not be pulled into the next world. So you say to yourself, well, what is this? Why is he telling us all of this? I have no idea why I shouldn't tell you all of this. Because the man and the show are one. The man and the show are one. This is the man you're listening to, Michael Savage. And the fact of the matter is, I have very profound dreams, which I have trained myself not only to remember, but to analyze the next day. Moreover, the reason I dream in color is because I take large doses of pyridoxine or vitamin B6, which will give you vivid dreams. And many people are afraid of their subconscious, which is why they drug themselves to death and take vacations and play golf. It's because they fear their inner self. They fear their inner mind. They've been taught not to listen to that still small voice within their own head. While I, on the other hand, have been training myself to not only listen to the still small voice, but to turn it into a talk radio show. Play the clip.
What is it about this president that has stripped away the veneer of respect that normally accompanies the office of the president? Why do Republicans think this president is unpresidential and shouldn't dare to request this kind of thing? It strikes me that it could be the economic times, it could be that he won so big in 2008, or it could be, let's face it, the color of his skin.
Come on, that's ridiculous. But identity theft is something you have to take seriously. What if someone stole your credit cards and try to destroy your life? Don't be a victim. Call my advertiser, LifeLock, today. Call LifeLock now at 1-800-LOCK-485 and get 60 risk-free days just for Savage listeners. 1-800-LOCK-485. Call them now. We have a dream interpreter on the phone. Trinity from Sacramento, welcome back to the Savage Nation. So you went into this field because what? You're an intuitive type of personality?
Yes. Absolutely.
Would you say that you come from a would you say you come from a family of women who could see around corners, so to speak?
You know, we didn't talk about my family didn't talk about it much. So, no, I don't come from a whole family of that. It's just been my own gift.
As a child, were you able to see things others couldn't see?
Yes.
In what way? Give me an example if you don't mind.
Oh, probably when I was 9 years old, I saw a guardian in my hallway, a man in all black. And, you know, it was quite scary at first until I realized he was there to protect me. He wasn't there to harm me.
They have now declared any vision a disease, a mental disorder, in order to make sure you can be drugged and possibly institutionalized. So how do you really learn how to interpret dreams?
By doing it, by practice, by working with people. I work in groups and I work individually.
Okay, and one last note. I mean, my doctorate is in nutrition from the University of California at Berkeley from 1978, and I've worked in the herbal and nutrition field for many, many years. You should remember this if we never speak again or whatever. Vitamin B6, pyridoxine, produces vivid dreams in color for individuals. I don't know if you know that. It's a very little-known fact.
No, I am familiar with that, and I have used that and some of my...
That's interesting. So that's become... That knowledge has now become part of the mainstream knowledge in people in your field? That's good, because that was originally written by Carl Pfeiffer in the 70s.
Yeah. No, that and, you know, some of us make teas as well.
Teas?
I don't know if you used mugwort or woodworm.
Well, woodworm is a very hallucinogenic herb. Absolutely. That's what we should warn you, that wormwood can also cause hallucinations that are of no benefit whatsoever in high doses. So you think my dream indicates that the female within me was being led to the next dimension? Not so much to remove me from life, but to instruct me?
Right. I don't necessarily think that the death was a literal death the way you were perceiving it. I think it's more of a metaphorical death of this level of consciousness. Especially your dream began with, I believe you said, the Yellow Submarine song. You know,
yes.
Kind of like to get your attention in this sort of musical, creative way.
Oh, but I never listened to the Beatles. Why would We All Live in a Yellow Submarine pop up in my head?
Well, I think often our dreams are there to surprise us, to grab our attention, to capture us. So something that you're not familiar with is bound to grab your attention more than something you're familiar with.
Actually, I do remember why We Are All Live in a Yellow Submarine came up. I was thinking of Libya and the politics of the Middle East and all the raging infernos going on around the world and all the different cultures and how cultures are clashing against one another and coming in contact with one another in ways we've never seen before historically in terms of the frequency of interactions between people of different cultures. And I the dream at first was I have to go on the radio and tell people that they have to be accepting of strange cultures because they're here and they're not going away. And the multiculturalists have destroyed America by jamming cultures that are foreign, truthfully, and alien to our way of life down our throats. It's failed in Britain. It's failed in France. It's failing in America because never before in history have those not learned when in Rome do as the Romans do. They now want the Romans to do as they did in their third world countries. Although they have fled their hellholes, they come here and tell us we have to live their way. So I was going to say that, and then the next thing it segues into this dream.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Joyce in New York, WOR, we have somebody on the Dream. Joyce, go ahead, please.
Hello, Mr. Savage. I'm delighted to be on your show. And a couple of months ago, I heard you describe a dream where you were singing in the streets. And I was almost going to call them because I realized that I could interpret that dream. And that dream is that you are a messenger and that you have something to say. The dream that you just had is the Eastern symbolism is the current condition of the world. The lady that you saw leave before you is America.
Mm.
And the reason you don't want to go is because you're the last voice standing.
Oh, my God. What an interpretation that is. In other words, America's life has been sucked out of her by the imagery was very, very clear. It was an Egyptian tomb, and it was of a seated woman, as you would see in, you know what I'm saying, Egyptian pictograms from Egypt, ancient Egypt. They always showed seated individuals, or very often they showed them seated, right, in an L-shape type of thing, like body, legs. And then she was brought next to that image, superimposed on the image. She fit perfectly, and they sucked her into it. I think that is the Arab Spring destroying America. In other words, this Arab Spring that we are being sold as the one of the greatest lies in history, it was orchestrated by Jimmy Carter, Brzezinski, and those in a think tank funded by George Soros. It was documented in a 16-page essay that I wrote about a year ago. They were behind the overthrow of Mubarak and what is going on in the Middle East. Now, what is it that they're doing? Are they trying to destroy America knowingly or by accident? Just remember, it was Jimmy Carter who overthrew the Shah of Iran and in so doing brought back Ayatollah Khomeini, who was in exile in France, and that started the disease, the virus of societies across the world. Radical Islam was stirred up by Ayatollah Khomeini, and it was a result of Jimmy Carter's do-gooderness. Either Jimmy Carter didn't know this would happen, he did it because he thought the Iranian people were suffering from Savak. He didn't know that the Muslim terrorists who would take over the country were worse than Savak, the secret police. In other words, the Islamic fanatic secret police are worse than Savak. So now we see the same thing going on in Libya, going on in Egypt, and this country is being sucked into this by the media. So are you saying that's Lady Liberty being sucked into that vortex and I resisted going?
Yes, I am, and especially when you said that she went and she conformed, and that's America.
Well, she conformed to the image that the silhouette was just exactly in her dimensions, is the point.
Yes.
She tried it on for size. They brought her next to the size, and she fit, and then she disappeared. Invisible hands pulled her into that next world. And then I remember being led there by invisible hands, or forces, rather, and I knew they wanted me to go. I wouldn't go. And I screamed, no, I'm not going. I would scream with everything in me. I'm staying here for my children. I'm staying here for my children. So you're saying I'm staying here to fight for America for my children?
You're staying here for us. You're the last voice standing. And
I can't say I'm the last voice. Why would you say the last voice? There are others who do the same thing, don't they?
Yes.
They don't do it the same way, but I mean.
I don't think so. I don't think that they do it with your integrity. I'm one of the Tea Party people in America and proud of it, and I'm a hardworking former business owner, taxpayer, and I've listened to your show, and I get a tremendous thrill out of a lot of things. We share the same spiritual beliefs, and I've been very drawn to call you and tell you about your dreams. And when I say the last voice, you're an authentic voice, and you are your own man. And there's so very few today that are representative of their own independent thinking that aren't their thoughts and ideas aren't being conformed by some other outside force. And I think
Joyce, what do you currently do professionally?
I'm a food service director.
Isn't no okay? Food. The way to a man's heart is through his stomach. To me, food is not disconnected from the mind. It's very much one and the same. Steve in Sacramento, I got to take your call. Go ahead, please. Steve, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. I think the portal in your dream represents an airplane door, and the invisible hands are that of your all of your family who want you to take that trip to Sardinia, and simply you just want to stay home and take care of Teddy and Tasha.
Oh, that's so prosaic. I love it. It makes me feel better. I'm not having to carry the world on my shoulders.
Well, and then God in the dream is saying, don't worry, Mike. Your family will keep your family safe while they're away. And there might be some.
That is amazing. Well, come on. It can't be the trip to Sardinia, because the imagery was so clearly Egyptian. And that's number one. It had nothing to do with Sardinia. There was no imagery from Sardinia. It was clearly Egyptian symbolism, number one. Number two, I didn't say I want to stay home to take care of my dog. I screamed to the invisible forces in my subconscious, no, you can't take me. I want to see my children. I want to see my children. And I remember thinking while I was doing it, Steve, that I have read of people who were being sucked into the next world in some while their life was being, hanging in the balance. And the thing that pulled them back from the other side was their children, that they wanted to stay here for their children. So as much as I would like to take the lightweight view that you have presented, I can't accept that. I really can't.
Savage.
You never know in talk radio whether a topic is going to grip people or not. And it's, strangely enough, disproportionately women who are calling, because women are more intuitive than men generally, I think. I am an unusual individual in that I've always had a very high degree of intuitive ability. I've also had the ability to read my subconscious, because I've trained myself to do it since I'm a young man, for whatever the reason. So in that sense, I resonate with women, I think. And I'm proud to say that, incidentally. I have no ashamed of that, that I have senses and sensitivity. You know, some women just don't like big, strong men with tattoos who can beat everyone up. I mean, there are women who like the macho guy with tattoos who could beat everyone up, and then there are women who hate that kind of man. So, in other words, you know, different strokes. Different strokes for different folks. I'm sorry to use an old 60s phrase. There's all sorts of types, you know what I mean? With some women like the tattooed, muscle-bound guy. The others like the intelligent, intellectual type of guy, even a little nervous. I think all women like geniuses, incidentally. I'm not sure. I think women like entertaining men, I'll tell you that. That's for sure. But that's a separate topic, actually. It's an interesting topic. Tampa, Florida. Debbie, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
I wanted to talk about the elderly with STDs. A few months back, I went to a bar in Naples, and there were like 80-year-old men that were trying to pick up like 50, 60-year-old women. There were women that had on spandex without bras. Walking around, it was the most disgusting thing.
What do you mean? It was like a senior pickup bar in Naples, Florida?
I swear to Michael, it was absolutely bizarre. It was like
I know that as a result of the Viagra type of drug, men are sexually active until they drop dead now.
Exactly.
And so, but the women generally lose interest in sex after a certain age. Where are they getting it for drive from? Do you think?
I have no idea. All I know is that there were 80-year-old men that were coming up to me, and I'm in my 50s. I look nice. I'm very, very married. But it was disgusting. There was a woman there. She had a shirt on with no bra. I mean, a woman after, 50 really needs a bra. Really needs a bra.
Yeah, I can't comment on that. I agree with you, though.
It was terrible, and I thought to myself, these people, I mean, have they not learned about AIDS? Have they not read the paper?
I think a guy at 80 figures, even if he gets a disease, he'll probably outlive the disease.
Maybe that's the comment.
I mean, between hair transplants and tooth implants and Viagra, what's to stop a guy today?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And the women are worse than the men.
Oh, well, maybe they're just enjoying the new sexual freedoms of America, where there's no morality, and everything's amoral, and they want to be, maybe they want to have what they didn't have when they were young.
I don't know.
In other words, let's take it out of the context of morality, okay? and let's just say they're doing it, older people are now having more sex and there's more STDs, is that necessarily a bad thing that a person has some excitement in their life? I mean, why should that be seen in a negative light necessarily?
Because they're, you know what, because I think that there's something about aging gracefully.
What should they be doing? I mean, working for the ACLU, packing, putting postage stamps on liberal mailers? I mean, what should they be doing? I mean, what does a man 80 do other than run after women?
Savage.
Talk Radio, Michael Savage. 1-800-449-8255 is the phone number. I think I need a vacation. I'd like to go to a campground for about 3 weeks. Play some jazz for me. I'm running out of steam here. I'm thinking of buying a campground because I don't want to go to one where anybody is there, actually. Look, I'm a loner. What can I tell you? If I have to listen to somebody for 1 minute, I go berserk. No, let me talk about that for a minute. Turn off the music. I went on the internet today because I had enough of the politics of another book coming out. I'm burned out. So I started to look in certain areas of Placer County, California, which is some of those has some of the most gorgeous lakes in the world. Gold Lake and things like that. So there's campgrounds up there that are on Forest Service land that are on long-term leases that the owners have. They have like five cabins. You know, some of them are rather primitive. Beautiful log cabins that I dreamed about as a boy. No television. You know what I'm saying? So I said, well, why don't I buy one of those lodges with five cabins? You know what I'm saying? And invite nobody there. Just be me and Teddy. Because I actually think at this phase of my life, I wouldn't be able to handle it. I don't think I could handle it anymore. Maybe when I was young, yes. But at this stage of my life, I don't think I could be alone in the woods anymore. I don't have a Thoreau thing in me. A lot of people go crazy, by the way, when they go back to nature. They don't tell you about that. Oh, yeah, it's a famous story. In the 60s, there was a couple. I forget who they were. They went back to nature. They were heroes of the liberals in the commie left, the peacenik back-to-earth movement. And they moved to Alaska to get away from it all, right? And they used to write articles. They'd live 6 months in Alaska in the outback, and then 6 months they'd live in the Caribbean when it got cold. So, all right, they have it both ways. All right, it's their business. Eventually, the guy walked into a propeller blade of a plane. He couldn't take it anymore. Just him and his long-toothed wife, you know what I'm saying? And the mosquito. Him and the mosquito and the wife, he walked into the propeller of the plane that came to get him. This is the problem. You can't do the back-to-nature thing anymore. It's too late. Thoreau is dead. Sacramento, Tony, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael, greetings from all your fans born in 1981.
Hey, thank you.
Recently, I went on a hike way up in the hills there and found a crystal clear, ice-cold lake, and I went swimming in it, and it was one of the most refreshing things I can remember in the past. I wondered if you were a swimmer, and if you
I am. I'm a very good swimmer.
I'm a
former lifeguard. I haven't saved anybody's life, but I'm a former lifeguard. Yeah, I'm a very good swimmer to this day. And the question is what, Tony?
Do you take advantage lately of the ice-cold, beautiful mountain?
You know, you're raising a very interesting point. I've read that immersing yourself in ice-cold water, although it's shocking, is one of the most healthful things you can do.
No,
I have an aversion to cold water. I don't really like cold water, Tony. Maybe what I need right now is throw myself in San Francisco Bay. I don't mean off the Golden Gate Bridge. I'm saying pull my boat into a cove. It's 58 degrees, the water, though. That's the thing. It's cold.
No, go up to a lake up on Mount Lassen and take a dive.
Yeah, what's the water temperature in a lake up there?
I don't know, but it was perfect. Probably a little bit warmer than 58 degrees.
Okay. Well, I remember there was an area in Alpine Meadows, California, that's a stunning. There's an area called Five Lakes. You probably don't know that area. In 1980, I was hiking up there a lot with family when the kids were young. I even was able to backpack one of my children on my back all the way to the top of the lake. You get up there in August, there's still snow on the ground, which to me is miraculously beautiful. and the lake, the ice has finally melted out in late August. The water is like ice water, you know what I mean, Tony? And at that time, Mrs. S. swam in that lake. I couldn't even put a toe in it. Some people have a capacity for cold water. I don't have it.
You should try again.
Yeah, you mean maybe it'll snap me out of my malaise?
It might do something for you.
It could give me a heart attack altogether. Or either way, it's better off than what I have now. Oh, God, I shouldn't get... Thank you for the... No, you got to be careful. I don't believe in shocking the system. I have my own exercise regimen. It consists in watching 5 to 6 hours of television after... No. I bicycle every day. I really do. I don't mean... You see, this is... I'm going to talk about exercise. Am I at a break point here or what? Where am I? I'm fine. I could talk for 3 minutes. Good. You know, a lot of guys drop dead in their 30s way back when from excessive running. They would run and look at the watches. Bingo. Blowout. So I was a runner when I was in my 30s. I weighed, you know, I was thin, low cholesterol, runner. Till one day I was running up to a waterfall. Every day I'd run to a waterfall. And I heard an inner voice screaming at me, stop running, stop running, stop running, stop running. So I thought I went crazy. So I stopped running. Never ran again the rest of my life. My body was warning me to stop running. And then in that decade, there were a lot of very famous deaths of runners. Jim Fix, for example, was a very famous runner. He wrote for Runner's Magazine, and he dropped dead while running. So you say, well, what does that prove? I'm not saying it proves anything other than the body is not made for continuous stress of this kind, the kind that people put themselves through with exercise. So as time went on, I started to study different methods of what's considered to be exercise. And the Chinese have it right. The ancient Chinese had it exactly right, which is the moderate approach to it. No excessive pushing of the body. At least that's what I interpreted it to mean. I mean, maybe it's my own interpretation. So if I bicycle, I bicycle moderately, not until I'm in a sweat bath and looking at a watch. I'm not doing it to sweat. I'm doing it to get some balance in my body. Balance is one of the most important things you can get in your body. So bicycling is excellent for gaining balance alone, even if you just do it to keep your balance. I've bicycled all my life, by the way. If I miss a day, I don't feel good. A couple of miles to town and back, go to look at people down in the mall, see what's going on, women, children, men, vendors. You know, it's like a touch of life. It's a real town. In a modern American suburb, the mall is actually our town, since there's no towns left to speak of. It's as good a town as any. So anyway, bicycle, look around, push around, get some, you know, yard time, go back to the prison of the computer and radio. But when it comes to pushing your body, I believe that many young men have it wrong, and they really push themselves too hard. They push and they push and they push and they run for a certain amount of time. They look good, don't get me wrong. They're thin, they're lean, they're in good shape. But I'm not so sure that that is so good to sustain for a very long period of time in your life. Moderate, moderate, moderate. And all you got to do is talk to an orthopedic surgeon about it if you think I'm making this up. The joints will go from excessive pounding. The hips, the joints are going to be replaced early on from the running. So there are other less, what do they call it? Less impact kind of sports that you can practice. But it's the same with weightlifting. You don't have to crunch weights for 5 hours a day. I mean, unless you're a Navy SEAL or something like that, or an Army Ranger or one of those, of course you want to be as hard as a rock. But I'm talking about the average person who wants to keep reasonably fit after the age of a certain age. That's all. You don't have to overdo it. That has been my philosophy. And thus far, it's worked for me. That's all. That's all I'm saying. I think that everyone has to come to their own ideas about what's going to work for them, and it comes back to the jumping in a cold lake. Now, maybe that's good shock therapy when you're young and it wakes you up. It's certainly invigorating. But I think after a certain age, if you leap into an ice-cold lake, you run the risk of a shock that could be fatal to your system. Things change, the body changes, people change, and you have to change with your age, you have to change with the ages as well. Nothing significant in what I just said at all.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language,
adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Everybody I speak with says, how can this man be a president? Everybody knows he's a faker. Everybody can see now that the king has no clothing. Everybody knows the man faked his way into the job. Everybody now knows America is suddenly in the greatest danger it's ever been. Everybody understands this is almost God speaking to us to show us how idiotic we become as a nation, that we would elect this empty suit, to use an overly used phrase, to the White House. But it's far deeper than that. Never underestimate individuals of this caliber. This man is extremely intelligent. This man, Obama, is extremely dangerous. This man is on a one-man mission to wreck this nation and all its traditions, in my estimation. As I have pointed out, and I'll repeat it over and over again, because it's the most important book written over the last 5 years. It's called Trickle Up Poverty. I spell it out in great detail. And I am telling you, we all know he's the naked Marxist. Those of us who have studied his background in college, going back to his upbringing by his mother, the man was raised to do what he's doing. It's as though he's the Manchurian candidate, if you want to put it in that juvenile context. And then you ask yourself, having said all of this, I've heard it all before. I heard it from all the people on the right wing. It doesn't make sense to me. But on the basis of incompetence alone, wouldn't you argue that there's something very wrong with the picture? Okay, moving on. At the risk of your displeasure, audience of the Savage Nation, yes, at the risk of your displeasure, I must go deeper than the surface of the news stories. I must drill down 5,000 years into the bedrock of Western civilization and see what the, let us say the Book of Books, the holiest book, the so-called Old Testament, the Jewish Bible, has to say about this situation. And I searched far and wide, and guess what I found? Something you haven't heard yet. Oh, you've all heard Ezekiel, you've heard Isaiah, you've heard Joshua, you've heard Ecclesiastes. Did you know Barak is in the Bible? It's in Judges. I found it. See, him and Deborah work together. Him and Deborah, Barak and Deborah work together, and I'll read it to you and see if this means anything to you. Barak, the son of Abinoam, was gone up to the Mount Tabor, and Sisera gathered together all his chariots, even 900 chariots of iron, and all the people that were with him, from Harashim Goyim into the brook Kishon. And Deborah said unto Barak, up, for this is the day in which the Lord hath delivered Sisera into thy hand. Is not the Lord gone out before thee? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor, and 10,000 men after him. And the Lord discomfited Sisera, and all his chariots, and all his host, with the edge of the sword before Barak. And you can read it yourself. The bottom line is that Barak, although we were told means peace in Hebrew, Barak was a warrior, incidentally. You should know that Barak was a warrior, as were all the prophets. None of the prophets were peaceniks. You see, there was no marijuana in those days. There were no communist camps for children in the Poconos back in the old desert days. And so all of the prophets had to put aside their writings and their readings and their prophesying, and they had to be warriors in those days. So even Barak was a warrior in those days, and I found him for you. It's all in Judges, and there's much more about what Barak was doing in those days. And you say, well, what does it have to do with now? Please don't bore me with this nonsense. What does this have to do with today? And he says he went down with 900 chariots of iron. Now, if you were one given over to symbolism, you could start doing numbers and you could say, wait a minute, why is that war? Why does that number 900 ring true to me, right? What do you mean 900 chariots of iron? Let's count the number of aircraft that Barak is using, along with the French and the Italians and the Danes and the whoever else is sending weaponry over there, and let's add up the other weapons. Do they add up to 900? I mean, you want to go through this? There are people who would do this. I'm giving you a lead for your churches on Sunday. I'm giving priests out there and ministers out there something to play with on Sunday to get the people hooked back on the Bible. Because as I said to you before, the only thing that could save America is a great return to the biblical edicts and the biblical preachings. Otherwise, we're finished. That's all. We're going to be nothing. Nothing. We're already almost nothing.
Savage.
All right, Greg in Chicago, you got my attention. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hey, Michael. You know, Obama learned his family, the federal family here in Chicago. Just in the past week here, we've had our tolls go up 87%. The past couple of weeks, we got a guy getting a former chief of detectives in Chicago Police getting out. Chicago Police is $150 million short. They're like 2,000 officers short. The new public schools chief who came here from New York is now saying that Ernie Duncan, one of Daley's dunces, you know, basically screwed up everything and underfunded schools, and they got money coming out their ears. It's like we got a dropout rate like it's going out of style around here. I mean,
well, but they could all go to work for Obama as refrigerator inspectors and come into everyone's house to see if you have an extra refrigerator in the garage. Exactly. They can give them a green uniform and hire them. That's what Maxine Waters would want, you know, to deputize the Black Panthers. You know, I was watching a thing on mobsters last night on one of the channels, and it was about Al Capone. I think I saw it before in 09. I don't know if you ever saw it on one of the history channels. And I was amazed that when Capone was finally nailed on income tax evasion, he had tried to bribe the jurors and couldn't. Then he tried to have the judge killed, and they were interviewing the judge's son. We're talking 70 years later. The guy's an old man himself. He said, the judge of the trial, they try to kill him, Capone. Try to kill the judge. They'd have police around them all the time. So I said to myself, is Chicago still like this? Greg, is it still? It isn't that bad, is it?
Well, I mean, it may not be that bad out in the street, so to speak, but yeah, it is. I mean, we've got a bunch of guys here who, for instance, this guy Blagojevich, this guy Kelly, who had, you know, started up a roofing company.
Who's a goy? Who'd you say is a goy?
No, it's a Blagojevich, one of his guys.
Oh, the goy. Oh, a Blagojevich. I'm sorry.
And, you know, I mean, these guys, all of a sudden, all these guys who are about to get indicted or they got to, you know, go rant out somebody else to save their own skin, or they have the capability of doing so, you know, suddenly they're all committing suicide, you know. One guy gets...
They are? They're taking the gas?
So forth.
They're taking the gas at the last minute to avoid ratting out people because they know their families will go if they do, right?
Right. That and you know, you hear people talking...
Well, you got to hand it to the Chicago mob. I got to tell you, they're brilliant in terms of having cultivated Obama. They got the perfect poster boy to have engineered the White House takeover, didn't they? I mean, come on. This was amazing. I mean, they knew exactly who to pick and how. Because Obama's policies are no different than that of Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton. It's just that he has a different appeal. You know what I'm saying? But basically, he's the same person. In the 1920s, I understand they used to give out $5 bottle of pints of cherry brandy to the poor in Chicago to have them to vote in the elections. And now they give them, I don't know what, food stamps? I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Savage Nation. And did you ever think you'd live through another year of Obama? But look, I don't want to do politics right now. It's Labor Day weekend. Most normal people are thinking about what they're going to be doing this weekend. They don't really care about the debate and next Tuesday and the NFL and the Obama blinked or the Republicans blinked. I can't even follow it personally, nor do I care. It's just too far ahead for me to care about it. I've got a big announcement to make, though, I'll tell you that. Do you know who is going to precede me on WOR in New York? Former Governor Patterson from New York is going to precede me on WOR, which is very interesting. Well, now you say, well, wait a minute, Savage, come on now. Wasn't he a Democrat? Yeah, but did you ever hear me bash Patterson? Almost never. Why? He was actually more, let us say, centrist than Bloomberg is in New York. So, I mean, the Patterson family goes way back in New York. Basil Patterson, I remember an awful lot of the family history in New York. You know what I want to do today? I'm going to read you something. I'm going to read you some titles, and I want you to answer the question. Would you rather I talk about the Keystone pipeline that runs from Canada to Mexico, or Obama, or the electric blue saddle-stitched pants, the fly in the tuna, Symphony Sid story, tough high school geometry teacher with two fingers on his right hand, happy and sad cufflinks, Woodchuck Bill, Fat Pat and Tippy the dog, Tippy dies and is thrown into a garbage truck, Dead Man's Pants, Sam the Butcher, Nutty Friend Who Had a Crazy Mother, Coney Island Wax Figures, Half Man, Half Woman in Long Beach, The Chestnut Man, One Arm Frank, Louie and His Crazed Monkey, The Nympho in Alley Pond Park, Love by the Sewer Plant, Fat Al's Tuna, My Silent Brother, My First Autopsy, My First Dead Body, My First Mortgage, Killing Mice in a Laboratory. Which would you rather I do? Would you rather I read or actually tell you some of these childhood stories, including new ones, that actually some of them came, a new one came to me in the middle of the night last night on the Savage Mind. The Savage Receiver Mind was on at 3 in the morning. You know what came to my mind? I was telling you a story yesterday on this show. Remember I said my friend's father was the toughest guy in the crowd, and boys tend to gravitate towards the toughest man in the circle because the tough men are usually the tribal leaders, which is always true. It's always been true, always will be true. Now, tough can mean tough of mind, tough of body. This guy was tough of body and tough of mind, so he led the boys, and I told you that. He was an Upper East Side bar owner when the other guys were petty merchants or had small menial jobs. You know, we were all immigrant families. Somehow he worked his way into opening a slick bar on the Upper East Side, and he was he wore suits. The other guys wore overalls or blue shirts. He wore a white shirt. But nevertheless, they were all in the same social milieu. He never put his nose up in the air. So I was thinking about him last night as I went to sleep, and you know what came to my mind was this. I remember once my friend's mom, who was married to this tough guy, took us to his bar. I don't know where she took us, the Ringling Brothers or whatever. And then in the middle of a sunny day, we went into this dark wood-paneled bar in the Upper East Side, and nobody was in there. It was almost like out of a Godfather scene, except the owner, who was this guy, and the bartender, who looked remarkably like the bartender who chokes Fat Clement, not Fat, the other one to death in the garden. It was like a, and we ate dinner in the place. And I'll never forget, as long as I live, it was remembrances of steaks past. When I ate that steak in that bar that he made for me and the other kid, his son, I finally ate steak. I had no idea that the steak I'd been eating in my house, it was like eating a catcher's mitt. I thought steak was supposed to be something you struggled with. I thought steak was something you had to attack like with a saw. This is not an aspersion upon my family, but I mean, we didn't have a lot of money, so I guess we got a cheaper cut of meat, or these guys knew how to tenderize it. But I remember cutting into that steak as long as I live and how tasty and soft it was. I said, I didn't even know this was what steak was supposed to taste like. So it reminded me of the old Buddy Hackett joke, another one, long dead. Who remembers him, right? You remember Buddy Hackett, old Catskill Mountains comedian, but one of the best. He got up once in front of an audience and he said, I never forget when I went to the Army to Fort Dix. He said, all my life, he said, I suffered from indigestion from my mother's food. He said, I ate the Army food and I didn't have indigestion. He said, I went to the doctor. I said, doctor, something's wrong with me. He said, why? He says, I have no gas, no indigestion. I don't feel like puking. What's wrong with me? In other words, he had never eaten a meal before that didn't get him sick. I thought it was funny, but it related to that in a sense of the steaks.
Savage.
JD in Las Vegas, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, finally, after 4 years, I have the privilege of speaking with you. I love your stories. I'm an old New Jersey guy who went into New York every day in the 60s and 70s. I love your stories growing up. But
I love Las Vegas. It's one, I mean, I don't go there anymore. I had an apartment there for a while. I'd go there. I used to eat an Italian restaurant down the street that I liked where they arrested those two New York homicide cops who were working for the mob. Very colorful city.
Which would that be the... Oh, son of a gun, I can't think of the name.
You know, you remember those guys? They were retired NYPD detectives, but they were on the payroll of the gangs in New York, and they were actually doing hits for the mob. And they arrested them in their jumpsuits in Las Vegas in the restaurant. They took them out of the restaurant in their jumpsuits.
The two New York cops, yeah, the one wrote a play, tried to get a TV movie, and the other guy...
There you go, right. Really upstanding, wonderful people. They give all police such a good name. They're like the liberal poster... They're poster boys for liberals' hatred for police. J.D., what's the climate? I don't mean, temperature-wise. The housing is horrible in Vegas now, right?
I've lived here for 40 years, Doctor, and this is the worst I've ever seen it. We have more illegal aliens doing all kinds of stuff. We are the highest in bankruptcies, the highest in foreclosures, the highest in unemployment. They say it's 14%, but our state's our senator, Whorehouse Harry Reid, says, oh, it's not that high. We probably are about 22% in unemployment. I've been coming to this town since 66, moved here in 77. I have never seen it so bad.
How do you take the heat in the summer in Las Vegas? How do you deal with it?
You don't go outside.
You just stay in air conditioning, that's it?
July, August, and September, you get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. You get your business and things done by 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, and then you don't go out until 7:30, 8 o'clock at night when the sun goes down.
It sounds like Miami in August. I mean, I can't even take Florida in the summer.
I was in Myrtle Beach last year in July. It was 97 degrees with 90-some humidity. The saving grace, you've been out here. We don't have humidity.
You don't have an ocean. You can't jump in the ocean. But I went to Florida like 2 weeks ago. It was like sticking my head in a pizza oven when I came out of the house. I felt as though I was back as a kid in a bagel bakery. A bagel bakery. It was so hot, I couldn't take it. And then I went in the ocean. It was full of jellyfish. I couldn't even swim. Hey, J.D., I'm going to tell you, J.D., I'm going to send you a copy of Abuse of Power. Stay on the line. You're going to get a free copy to read around Vegas, start the ball rolling, and stuff like that. We got wonderful callers. We got people listening from around the country, mainly men, truthfully. It's not a woman's show. This is not a... I mean, there are maybe 13, 14 women members of the Savage Nation across the country, admittedly. It's mainly grouchy old white males, maybe... 200-300 white males across America listen to me. No one else does. Now, allegedly, it's the third largest radio show in America with 10 million people. But if you were to listen to the Congressional Black Caucus, it's probably 300 white crackers who want to hang people from trees. I'm Michael Savage. We'll be right back.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Joining us right now is a man who knows what Obamacare will do to business, because he is a very successful businessman and a candidate for the presidency, and someone I really support, because of all the candidates on the Republican side, Herman Cain is the only one that I know of who produced a product or a service that is of any value whatsoever. And so without further introduction, we introduce to the Savage Nation candidate Herman Cain. And it's a real honor, sir. Thanks for being with us.
Mr. Savage, Michael, this is Herman Cain. Thank you. And let me just say, based on your introduction, I fought Hillary Care back in the early 1990s. And Obamacare is worse. This ruling by the 11th Circuit Court, is absolutely news to my ears and the news to every business person in America. Because like you said, this is a job killer. But, you know, the liberals, they don't care about jobs. They only care about their agenda. So thank you for having me on, Michael.
Well, okay, let's start with the top of the discussion. You know, you have the Republican candidates vying to come out in the front of the field. And I'm not trying to trounce the others, but amongst all of the candidates, Mr. Cain, you seem to be the only one who stands out in terms of actual business experience. I do know that Mr. Romney ran an investment firm. That is true. But in terms of product, I'll take a pizza over a fiduciary instrument any day.
You know, you're right. And the difference is I actually made a pizza in the restaurant before I ran the company. I actually made a Whopper before I ran 450 Burger King restaurants.
Are you saying you actually were a pizza maker?
Yes, because my philosophy whenever I took over a new business was to learn how that business works from the most fundamental basic level. I actually went into the restaurant and went through some training for a couple of days so such that if I'm making these decisions out of my executive office, I know what I was talking about. I did the same thing at Burger King. I went in, I ran a Burger King restaurant before they made me a vice president, even though I had already been a vice president at Pillsbury before.
Interesting.
My philosophy is just real simple. If you want to know how to solve a problem, or you want to better understand the business, get down there and get your hands dirty and do it for a while so you can better understand it. And this is the difference between my business experience and Mitt Romney's all candor, because I've not only run small businesses, medium-sized businesses, saved businesses, started businesses, I've actually made the sandwiches and made the pizza. And that's the difference between the kind of business experience that I have.
Well, look, fiscally, you're a real conservative, and Mr. Romney, and I think he's a wonderful man. I had dinner with him a year and a half ago. He won't acknowledge it today. This is typical of so many politicians. I'm pretty sure if you and I sat down over a pepperoni, you wouldn't hide it the next day. And I hope we can do that one of these days. No, in San Francisco, but he won't acknowledge he had dinner with me. And the interesting thing is, he's a very nice man. He's personable. He has a wonderful background. He has four, wonderful family, honestly. However, he's not a true Republican in the sense of a conservative. He's a liberal Republican on the order of a Rockefeller or even a Bush one, truthfully. And that's not what America needs now, in my estimation.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, with all due respect, look, I don't have any name against Mitt Romney, but the difference is, the first difference is what I just described. My business experience has been more hands-on throughout my 40-year career, no matter which job I held. Secondly, I came from very humble beginnings, and I don't have any heart feelings against people who came into a good situation when they
right.
were born.
No, neither but do I. Mother, I'm nothing my, against
yeah.
people who inherit
no,
money.
Have,
God bless them. You know what I'm saying? I hope I leave my children and children's children something.
But see, the thing is, I had a very humble beginning, so I can better relate to the people that are struggling, because my mom was a domestic worker, my dad was a chauffeur and a barber, and he held jobs that he needed to do in order to get by. So I can identify better with the people who are almost unemployed. I can better identify with the people that are unemployed. I've got relatives that can't find a job because of this sorry, lousy economy. So I can identify more with that. And so,
Mr. Kane, let me. I'm curious now. You've got my curiosity. And first, let's stick to the presidential thing, because I'm trying to think of my audience and of my own interests at the same time. How did you actually begin in the corporate world? How'd you climb the ladder?
When I graduated from college in 1967, I was one of the first ones in my family to ever graduate from college. Went to work for the Department of the Navy as a mathematician. I was a mathematics and physics major.
Whoa. Well, now, why don't we know that? Why doesn't America know that Herman Cain was a mathematician?
And guess what I worked on when I first got out of college? Fire control ballistics for fire control systems on our naval ships and on our naval aircraft. I was a fire control systems ballistics analyst when I first got out of college because of my mathematics and physics background.
That's amazing. No, but you see, I didn't know that. Here I have you on my show, so everyone knows the number one, African-American businessman, but they don't talk about your educational experience or your background. Why? Because it doesn't fit the stereotype, I guess, huh?
No, it doesn't fit the stereotype. They don't want to talk about my background and know that I can count, know that I have an analytic mind, although I can communicate with people. And then after being a ballistics analyst for fire control systems for 6 years with the Department of the Navy, I wasn't in the Navy. I was a civil servant for 6 years. Then I went into the corporate world, worked at Coca-Cola, then Tillsbury, and I was able to climb the corporate ladder at Tillsbury to become a vice president. Then I went over to Burger King with a career change to get into the restaurant business, and I had to climb that corporate ladder. And eventually, because of all of that success, Pillsbury appointed me president and CEO of Papa's Pizza. Because of that job, I then later was asked to become head of the National Restaurant Association, which today is the second largest employer in the country next to government.
That's amazing. Well, no, I understand who they are. They lobby for businesses, rightly so. I have friends in the restaurant business in San Francisco who have warned me for years. Do you know what they've done in taxing restaurants in San Francisco?
Right.
They've added a medical tax to the sales tax in San Francisco, 1% on top of everything to pay for health care in that city?
They don't know anything else to do, Michael, except tax, tax, and tax, and spend, spend, and spend. This is what's wrong. You are absolutely right. And the same mentality has gone to Washington, D.C., which is one of the reasons that I decided to run for president. I never wanted to run for president. This wasn't a lifelong dream.
Right.
I have done this because this country has been good to me. And from my humble beginnings, I have been able to achieve my American dreams and then some. But I feel a responsibility because I've got three grandkids, and I'm thinking about all of the other little faces out there, and what are we going to leave to them? And so this is why I decided to run for president.
Well, you and I resonate. We're almost the same generation. We are within a few years of college graduation, so I assume we're in the same age bracket. We see the world probably... through the same eyes. My father was not a college graduate. He was a small, he was an immigrant and all of that. And he struggled. I saw what it did to him, struggling. Okay, but he taught me the work ethic. So I relate to you. But when I watch you and I listen to you, I look past the stereotype that I'm supposed to see, okay? Because it's very easy to dismiss you. And, you know, people are going to dismiss you, say, oh, he's a black guy, so they moved him up. That's not true. They should understand what your background is. And I would I'm trying to say to you, I would emphasize my mathematical background. In an age of numbers where the numbers are being juggled by the phonies on Wall Street, your ability in physics and mathematics should be paramount in any discussion. You could run rings around the other candidates.
That's a good suggestion. That's a very good suggestion. I guess because of my, being all honest, because of my humility, I don't pull it up. But, you know, you make a very good point. A lot of people don't know that, and if I don't bring it out, then a lot of the listeners won't.
But,
know
yeah, but he, listen, I swear to you, you know, we're talking as though we're sitting in a restaurant together, which is what I tend to do on a national radio show with millions of listeners. But, Mr. Kane, you're running for the presidency. I watched you, and I said, this man, you know, he talks the talk, but he's also walked the walk in order to talk the talk. Yeah. And now I learned that you were a mathematics major in college, which is no mean achievement. That's a tough one. I know what it means to be a physics and mathematics major. That's a tough road to go down. And I would suggest in any debate, I think you ought to remind people of that. Now, it's true that Ms. Bachman was a tax attorney to her credit. However, people should know what your background is.
That's a good point. And by the way, my mathematics and physics degree was from Morehouse College, but I have a master's in computer science from Purdue University. I just thought I'd throw that in, Michael.
No, keep going. I think America's going to be pleasantly introduced to the new Herman Cain because, you know, you're a humble man. I can see that in your demeanor and the way you present yourself. I say to myself, God, what if he really gets, you know, look, it's very early on in the campaign and people are trying to decide who they want to bet on which horse. And a lot of people say, oh, I don't know. I like Herman Cain, but I don't know because he can't win. What do you mean he can't win? You certainly could win.
That's right. In fact, if they go to my website, HermanCain.com, HermanCain.com, they'll be able to look up more information on me and about me and see what my background is. They'll also be able to see many of the speeches that I have given across the country. You know, when you're watching the debate, you're only going to get a snapshot of an individual. In that debate that was on TV, I actually was on camera front and center for about 7.5 minutes out of all of those minutes because they were more interested in creating catfights between some of the candidates than allowing the American people to really learn something about what you would do. And so I encourage people to go look at my website where they can learn more about my views, my ideas, as well as my background.
All right, clear enough. And as a businessman, you and I both know that much of the hard work in this country and the manual labor is done by illegal aliens, and we all know that. You got to be blind not to see that, and you got to be a fool not to speak about the realities of it. So let's go to the hardest question of the night, which is the economy, the economy, the economy. As a mathematician, as a businessman, how would you rescue this economy from the abyss?
My economic vision, which I have documented on my website, HermanCain.com, has two phases. Phase one is to immediately give this economy a boost in the first 90 days after I become president. We must lower the top corporate and personal tax rate to a maximum of 25%. Secondly, zero taxes on repatriated foreign profits. And thirdly, zero capital gains tax. Fourthly, and most importantly, make them permanent. Make them permanent because uncertainty is killing this economy.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to believe that that would provide a tremendous boost to this economy, which we badly need. And the reason that I would keep it that simple is because the American people can understand it, they embrace it, and they will put pressure on Congress to pass that first piece of legislation. I'm not going to throw a lot of other garbage in there that's going to confuse people. No,
right.
It's simple, and we can boost the economy. That's
I agree 100%.
Exactly.
Herman Cain, I know you took an extra bit of time with us tonight, and I think we made an enormous impact on millions of Americans this evening. Please, folks, go to HermanCain.com, and I want to thank you, Mr. Cain. And remember my slogan, Cain is able. It's not a bad one.
It's not a bad one, Michael. I already got some bumper stickers with that on.
Good luck. Thank you.
Savage.
The Republicans right now are using the idea of deficit reduction as an excuse.
Yes.
They're hijacking an idea that has some resonance. We all want to reduce the deficit in order to not reduce the deficit, but to destroy the public space. Whether it's public schools, public safety, clean air, clean water, food safety, reform on Wall Street, protections for consumers, you name it, forget about it. They're defunding every initiative in that regard. You wonder, do their children breathe air? Do they drink water? Why do they not care?
Did you hear that? And it's organizations like the AARP who control these leftist politicians. AMAC is fighting back. The Association of Mature American Citizens. Your membership can help stop the left wing. Call 800-255-4199. 800-255-4199 or go to AmericaIsRising.com. 800-255-4199. AmericaIsRising.com.
Savage.
Now let me say something about talk radio. And this is for everybody listening to this show and everybody in the industry of talk radio. Let me be the leader once again. Let me come out from behind the shadows and say something to you in the industry. Many of you are walking around with your heads between your tail between your legs and your heads between your arms, thinking that talk radio is finished, that the internet is king, and the young people don't listen to talk radio, and that we're old, it's old media. Nothing could be further from the truth. Talk radio is reaching the taxpaying American voter. Make no mistake about it. And study the words that I just used for you. Those words were carefully chosen. Talk radio reaches the taxpaying American voter. Notice I said the taxpaying. I didn't say working American voter. I said the taxpaying American voter listens to talk radio religiously. And you are the people who should be shaping the future of America, not the non-taxpaying, non-working American, or the non-taxpaying, non-working immigrant, or the non-working, non-taxpaying welfare recipient, or the government worker. And I can prove to you that talk radio is still the most powerful element of the American media. And that is simply, I posted Abuse of Power. I mentioned it only a few times and I asked you to buy it. And I moved it from 145,000 on Amazon to number 34 in one day. Talk radio is the most powerful outlet in the American media landscape.
Savage.
In the midst of all of this madness, you do have to find your corners of sanity and peace. For me, it's water. I've always loved going out on the water. And I go out on my boat. So yesterday, I didn't think I'd get out. What's the point of going anywhere? But I wanted to go out on the boat, but I don't want to go out in a 25, 30 knot wind. I'm really not in the mood for the merit badge, in the, you know, as I say, in stormy weather. So I'm waiting, waiting, waiting. So the weather breaks a little bit. So I call up my friend Mike, who's like, he's a captain. He delivers boats. Great guy. And Mike, you want to go out? All right, I just delivered a boat. I'll come down in an hour because I didn't want to go out in even the mild wind alone. I can handle my 40-ton boat alone in decent weather, calm weather, and I do. But on a windy day, I really didn't want to come back with Teddy. I'm alone with Teddy. To try to dock with a poodle running around back and forth, he always thinks he's docking the boat with me. I mean, it's really funny to watch. The guy loves to hear the kid, the dog, a kid guy. I don't know what he is anymore. It's like I'm a human being to me at this point. I'm going batty altogether. He's so attached to me. I'm so attached to the dog. I don't know whether he's a person or an animal, or I'm an animal or a dog half the time, or a person. We're like one in the same. We're bonded. So when I pull into a dock and I have to jump off the boat, he jumps too. And he tries to grab the lines and tie them up for me with his mouth. It's very cute, but very dangerous at the same time, because you got 40 tons of fiberglass, steel, stainless steel, teak, gasoline, diesel fuel, rather, and oil and all sorts of things. You don't really want to be worried about a door getting squashed between you and the dock. So I figured, all right, Michael, go out with me. So we go out, and it was absolutely incredible. And I was, again, one with nature, just a small 10-knot, 12-knot run down the bay. I like to watch the water or the movement of the water. I like to look at the landforms, which are amazing. You know what we have here in Northern California? We have an amazing geography in that you have pine-studded mountains that drop drastically right into the bay, and then you have 70 feet of water right offshore, 15 feet offshore, 10 feet offshore. You could be in 70 feet of water because fundamentally the entire Bay Area is on mountaintops, which, of course, if you're into geology as I am and botany as I am, you realize that we're here as visitors on a very we're visitors on this planet for a very, very brief interval, not only geologically a very brief interval, but of course, in terms of our own life cycle. But you take a look at this, a bay like this, or wherever you may be, you look around, you see all this landform, you're on mountaintops, and look at what we, the ants, have accomplished in such a short period of time geologically as we have inhabited these mountaintops, I said to myself as we continued the boat through downtown Sausalito.
Savage.
Where did all of these people come from with nail parlors? Are there really that many women who have their nails and toenails done in this country? How can we really have that much poverty? I mean, I'm thinking about this. You know, having your nails and toenails done is actually costly. How can every yenta in this country afford to have her nails and toenails done? How is that possible? I frankly, I don't know, maybe I come from another time. But when I go past the nail parlor and I peek in on my bicycle, I want to gag. And where did all of these nail parlor women come from? I don't know. What's the difference?
Savage.